Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Spotlight Africa. I am Assumpta Oturu. Spotlight Africa brings you news, analysis and current affairs of the African continent, including global issues affecting Africa, the African diaspora and the global south. Today we devote the hour to the impact of global realignment of forces on Africa and the global south, which seems to foster what was once called the South-South Dialogue. It also realizes what the Global South demanded in the 1970s for a new international economic order.
It would have been, ironically, much better business for America and for Europe if they had facilitated instead of impeded the growth aspirations and infrastructure aspirations of Africa and Asia and beyond over the past 60, 70 years. They could have had continents and peoples who could be much more productive, who would be able to purchase the productions of the United States at higher quality goods. We could be purchasing from Africa higher quality finished goods as well if they had manufacturing, as many of the African leaders from the 50s and 60s had tried to do, like Kwame Nkrumah and others.
The relationship between China and Russia presents what is now emerging as a different economic infrastructure. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, in his recent speech to 23 Arab League member nations, was quoted as saying in an extract of the speech, begin quote, "We are beginning a new era, which would be a move towards real multilateralism, not to the multilateralism which the West tries to impose on the basis exceptional role of the Western civilization in the modern world. The world is much richer than just Western civilization. Who but not many of you representing the ancient civilizations should know this. And I think the movement is unstoppable," end quote. As this happens, Africa will move away from her current colonial prescribed economic status.
Africa, historically, sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone. And this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is.
I am Assumpta Oturu. Stay tuned to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and streaming live on kpfk.org.
What I tried to communicate as best as possible in that article, which was first published on The Cradle, to get across that the multipolar alliance is something which is much more than people realize, and there is much effort being made by mainstream Western press to try to paint the multipolar alliance, meaning Russia, China, a variety of other nations of Eurasia, especially Iran, India being major players, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, others. There's a lot of effort to try to paint it as just another empire of exploitation to be afraid of. There's so much propaganda. When you look at the actual accomplishments, not just the words of leaders in China or in Russia or beyond, but you look at, well, what has China especially, which is the biggest economic capability to construct real world developments, infrastructure, industries, what have they done? And does it justify the fear and the propaganda which we are being fed? And I tried in the course of my article to demonstrate that no, this is not just another exploitative empire, just like the unipolar, you know, many people call it the rules-based international order led by the United States, Britain, and the old colonial powers of Europe, which is really what is shaping much of the transatlantic destiny currently, unfortunately, and it's not a very good destiny, but it's much healthier and it's much more premised around honest business and an idea of building full spectrum economic powers in countries who have suffered a lot of exploitation for a long time. And Africa has suffered more than I think any continent in the world under dishonesty, imperialism.
That was Dr. Matthew Eret, who is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He's a geopolitical analyst and the director of the Rising Tide Foundation, based in Montreal, Canada. The major aim of the Rising Tide Foundation is to foster cross-cultural understanding. Dr. Matthew Eret has authored numerous books, and his recent article entitled Russia in Africa, Connecting Continents with Soft Power, prompted this interview on the impact of the realignment of global forces on African economies. It is this realignment of forces that could bring to reality what the Global South once called for a new international economic order. The then proposed new international economic order in the 1970s would move the economies of the Global South out of the imposed colonial economic structure and their positioning in the world economy. Today, China and Russia want to change that global order to a global economic order that is inclusive and beneficial to all. Now, Dr. Matthew Eret explains such a possibility from the current reality. Dr. Eret is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He's a geopolitical analyst.
Yes, that's right. The forces of history are already at play, and the West has demonstrated currently that it is holding on to an obsolete ideology which has no role to play in the new era of humankind. And I think that on February 4th of this year, weeks before the Russian military intervention into Ukraine began, you had the Russia-China Joint Declaration for Cooperation in a New Era. And I think reading that is very useful. It's a 5,000-word document, a real powerful, spirited document, which declares a common brotherhood and a common way of thinking about win-win cooperation going forward into the 21st century, which is very much demonstrating its influence, I think, in the case of the continent of Africa, which was the topic of my article, which you had read, where I try to get across as best as I can using concrete examples of projects that have been built or are being built or are planned to be built that are tied to the spirit of the Belt and Road Initiative, as well as other north-south transportation corridors, which are transforming and uniting the Eurasian economic area. The entire Eurasia is being united by a new type of spirit of building large-scale mega projects, new infrastructure corridors, which is it's much superior to anything we have lived in the West as far as our relationship to the Middle East, Southwest Asia, Africa. In the West, there has been a darker agenda since World War II, especially to destroy and subvert the aspirations of former colonialized nations to have economic independence. And we are seeing no evidence that those types of dishonest agendas are underlying the multipolar Russia-China alliance in especially Africa, where, again, I try to go through case studies of Ethiopia, Kenya, Sudan, Egypt, and beyond, just to demonstrate, well, what has been built? Are they just using words? Are they just giving money in order to create debt slaves, as we have seen under the IMF or the World Bank for so many decades? Or are they actually building real things which are provably pulling people out of poverty into higher education, into higher standards of living? And most importantly, are they providing nations the ability to increasingly stand on their own two feet in trust and cooperation with their neighbors, which is what Africa very much needs, as do every country needs that. So I tried to do my best as I could to demonstrate some of those projects, both the ones that have been built, are being built, or can be built, and are being discussed right now.
China today speaks of the Belt and Silk Road, a concept that invokes the Asian Silk Road that linked the East and the West in a network of Eurasia trade routes. The current Belt and Silk Road implies the construction of infrastructure, railway lines and ports that connect the three continents, Asia, Africa, and Europe.
It's a bit of both. I think the potency, power of the ancient Silk Road from the Han Dynasty era 2,000 years ago was that it was a basis of intercultural dialogue, exchange, as well as commercial practices, trade routes between East and West. From China, you have interconnectivity with the Muslim world that was created with the Christian world, especially with the recovery of the Silk Road in the 7th century under the Tang Dynasty, where it endured for several hundred years. With that, you have something very important about the way we tend to organize ourselves as human beings on this earth in harmony with neighbors who don't sound like us, don't worship with the similar rituals as we do. But we have so much more in common as human beings who can make things better, can create together, can share poetry and new scientific discoveries. So this is something which is very important for creating peace, is understanding. You know, we tend to fall into the traps of going to war with our neighbors on behalf of geopolitical manipulation, usually when we are ignorant of our neighbors and their traditions, and it's difficult to respect them. So you have so many different points where the Silk Road idea has high value. And what China did, especially in 2013, was revive that old Silk Road concept, but with some 21st century advances, obviously. So it does involve intercultural dialogue, exchange, sharing, which is important, East and West, but it also involves high-speed rail, conventional railroads being built up with new transport corridors stretching from different points in China all the way through the mainland across one branch in the north is through Russia. Another one goes through Central Europe into the Caspian Sea with ports that then unload goods from trains onto ships, which then bring them back onto trains in Turkey, which can go through into Europe. I think the most exciting lines are the southern routes that stretch from Pakistan. You know, the China-Pakistan relationship is very important right now. And there's lines that go into Afghanistan that are increasingly coming online into Iran, as well as from Iran into Iraq, into Syria, Lebanon, with ports that could then extend into goods going to and from Europe. We have branches that are also on the sea. So I discussed the land routes, but you also have sea routes, ports being developed all over the Gulf Coast region, as well as around Africa. Many of that involve Chinese funding because China has a great economic power through its central banking system that is nationalized, unlike many of the other countries of the West who have rendered their central banks relatively useless for long-term development because they're under the control of the IMF, the World Bank, and the City of London. In China, they always maintained a control, and thus they have the ability to emit large-scale credit for big projects with low interest, sometimes no interest. As we've seen now, China just erased the debts of 16 African nations who had received loans at zero interest. That's all been erased now. It's a very good act of goodwill. But so these ports are being built up all around Eurasia with even Arctic components that involve Russia. And as you mentioned, there's a north-south transportation corridor, which is also synergistic. It was first announced in 2001 by Russia, Iran, and India. Because of the wars in the Middle East and geopolitical manipulations, it has received a much slower start. But what we have seen in the past 2-3 years is a real renaissance of that north-south corridor that stretches through Turkey, through Armenia, Georgia, into Iran. And it involves about 17 countries, ports in Iran, Bandar Abbas being one, but there are several ports. That the goods that would be shipped from St. Petersburg, even more north now into the Arctic, would go to and from into India, which is moving more in harmony with the Belt and Road Initiative. So you have east-west and north-south. And finally, as I point out in my new article on Africa, many of the diverse projects that China has been working to build, other countries have been working as well. Egypt has done a lot of good. Some Gulf states as well are getting on board. In Africa are actually not separate projects. There is a unifying quality with major transcontinental African rail lines that have been discussed, as well as highway systems.
Before you go into that, maybe we can sort of get an understanding, because this seems like promoting what we used to be referred to the South-South dialogue, and also seems to promote what in the 70s was discussed as the new international economic order that the southern countries of the global South were demanding. But now that it is actually something that is happening, how does the West view this as a threat?
Unfortunately, the West is captured currently by an imperial ideology which thinks that if their slaves develop independence, that the slave masters will not be able to continue to reap the advantages that they have from being at the top of the food chain, so to speak, which is very unfortunate, because all of history has proved that, in fact, it is only when slaves they do capture and fight for their freedom that they can acquire the mental and physical skills to create real wealth. And it's actually much more preferable, it's better for business when you have thinking, hopeful, creative people who are participating in common projects. It would have been, ironically, much better business for America and for Europe if they had facilitated, instead of impeded, the growth aspirations and infrastructure aspirations of Africa and Asia and beyond over the past 60, 70 years. They could have had continents and peoples who could be much more productive, who would be able to purchase the productions of the United States at higher quality goods. We could be purchasing from Africa higher quality finished goods as well if they had manufacturing, as many of the African leaders from the 50s and 60s had tried to do, like Kwame Nkrumah and others. But China and Russia and other Eurasian countries recognize, and I'm glad that you said that, like when Fred Wills from Ghana had announced with many other leaders of the global South in the 70s, the call for a new economic architecture, a new just economic system, they were invoking the spirit of Bandung, the process in Indonesia that gave rise to the five and then 10 principles of peaceful coexistence, which was arranged by leaders in India and China and much of Africa, because they could see that the logic of the Cold War, of each against all, had no future. It was a logic of global extinction. And the advantages that the stronger victors of the Cold War, the United States, the British Empire, and I do think that the British Empire still has many powers even today that are active through their controls of the Five Eyes, the City of London, banking sector. That's really where the major power resides, even controlling much of U.S. foreign policy even now. I think that that type of advantage that they think that they got during the Cold War period was illusory, because it was premised around the idea of creating a world that was more at war with itself, that had hated, that would grow to despise the United States more and more. Even the United States and Europe became increasingly economically weaker and less capable of even having their own, governing their own affairs properly as sovereign nations. So Russia and China, I think, are much more in alignment with the spirit of Bandung, the spirit of the non-aligned aspirations back in the day. And they recognize what just good common sense business is. You know, you don't want to burn the world. You don't want to destroy the world with nuclear war. You don't want to destroy your partners. You'd rather work to help your neighbors get better so that they trust you and admire you and respect you and you respect them. It's just good business. And it's much more in harmony, I think, with human condition.
Boku diskis bokbiene sans frontière bolesu am tilige menu dajé baña xadal kenu sunu digënté waratuñu nangu kenn ñew diñu sewel bu jité rew fokné la fané ki yow ya ko mom yi bu deugël dala wara fétu ñu bëgg sa rew té sanku dimbal dimbal ne ca fétu lokal koro. More with Dr. Matthew Eret later, as we now take a music and station break. I am Assumpta Oturu. You are listening to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. and streaming live on kpfk.org. Coming up next, Dr. Eret speaks on the African Continental Free Trade Agreement and the recent implementation of one of the major parts of that agreement, the Pan-African Payment and Settlement System. Dr. Eret refers to the Pan-African Payment and Settlement System as de-dollarization of Africa.
Walk together, keep on walking. Cheikh Ante Diop, Kwame Nkrumah, Stephen Biko, Olumide. Africa, Africa, unite.
Do you have a car, a boat, or a motorcycle that's really ready to go, kind of like on its last legs? It's probably been really good to you. Well, check out this idea. How about let it do one more good thing and benefit KPFK? Your donation is tax deductible and it's easy to do. For more information about how the donation process works and how to get your tax deduction, all you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's it.
The African Continental Free Trade Agreement came into force in January 2021. It is the largest world trade agreement that brings together 55 member countries of the African Union, AU. The African Continental Free Trade Agreement aims at creating a single continental market with a population of about 1 billion people, with the gross domestic product estimated at $3.4 trillion. The recent launching of the Pan-African Payment and Settlement System is one of the major aims of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. Dr. Eret refers to the Pan-African Payment and Settlement System as the de-dollarization of Africa. Dr. Eret is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He is a geopolitical analyst.
It's one of several components of a much more comprehensive long-term plan for basically pulling Africa into the 21st century and with full modernization quickly, because Africa has to do very quickly what the Western parts of the world in Europe and North America had 300 years to do. Africa must leapfrog very, very quickly. And you know, China wants to help. They don't have the problems of the West. They don't try to talk down to Africa and tell African nations that you're not allowed to have advanced technologies. You must only have appropriate technologies that do not change your natural ecosystems or tribal cultural lifestyles too much, which is patronizing and racist, really. So the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, it removes about 95% of the tariffs of the countries of Africa, many of whom have not been permitted to have a trade amongst themselves. This is the old plan of empires, divide to conquer. It does now permit for common easy visas, passports across different African countries. So up until now, it has been cheaper for many countries, people wanting to visit from one African country to another one, to first fly to Europe and then to fly from Europe back into Africa, which is absurd because of the airport infrastructure. Airline infrastructure has been so underdeveloped. The logistical infrastructure to provide for easy passport delivery and finalizations have been very, very poor. So this is now really making things streamlined. It's facilitating inter-African trade and development, which is also very good for countries like Africa, Eurasia, which is also moving ahead on free trade agreements with Africa. China is very, very hungry for this as well. And free trade can work very well if all parties are interested and committed to real, honest, mutual development of all participants. If you have dishonesty or multinational corporations trying to get nations to do free trade, they're not going to play by the rules that they want their victims to abide by, which is opening up your borders, lowering tariffs, and basically letting thieves come into your house after you've removed your alarm systems. We don't see that with Russia or China. It's a very different spirit. Same thing for India. There's a much more honest intention to use these free trade agreements and special economic zones like Russia's building in Egypt or Mozambique for the purpose of actually beneficial trading and cooperation.
So on the issue of de-dollarizing Africa, can you elaborate on that, Dr. Eret?
Well, that's happening at its own pace as well. But, you know, part and parcel with this program is the Pan-African Payments and Settlements System. Up until now, every nation for the past 70 years has been forced to settle all payments and trade balances through U.S. dollars and having U.S. reserves, U.S. dollar reserves, basically because the U.S. has been the most powerful economic unit of the world for a very long time. It was understood that the U.S. dollar is kind of like it's better than gold, you know. That's no longer the case. The U.S. is bankrupt, beyond bankrupt. It's on the verge of a complete economic and social collapse. This is something which has induced many countries to find alternatives. And Russia, China both have created alternatives to SWIFT. It's an interbank system of settling payments. So China has their own, Russia has their own, which allows for trade balances to be settled in local currencies, renminbi, as well as rupees. India and Russia have similar deals to settle trade in rupees and rupees. Now with the Pan-African Payments and Settlement System, local currencies can increasingly be used as well, not just US dollars. So it's not powerful yet, but it's growing, and it's growing very fast in conjunction with the Eurasian alternatives at the same time.
In light of the realignment of global forces, the United States is trying to force African countries back to its camp. And this was the aim of the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken's recent visit to key African countries. In South Africa, Secretary Blinken received what some call a lecture from the South African Foreign Minister, Naledi Pandor.
To come in and seek to teach a country that, you know, we know how democracy functions and we've come to tell you, you do it, you know, it will work for you. I think it leads to defeat. So we need to think in different ways. I also think that one of the lessons we also need to learn and perhaps draw lessons from, one of the experiences we should draw lessons from, is the reality that there has been a lot of external interference in Africa. And a lot of that external interference has fueled conflict in many African countries, has supported opposition groups against liberation fighters and so on. You know the history perhaps better than myself. This is a reality. In my view, while there may be concern about Wagner Group or Van Dyck, which is another security group which was in Mozambique, there's also a concern about countries that have mineral interests in African countries and are there as a destabilizing force. So I think we need to look at the full plethora of problems that give rise to insecurity, bad governance, and the absence of democracy on the African continent. It's not a one country problem. It's a world phenomenon which is results from Africa's rich mineral wealth that has made it a significant target of external players that don't always have the interests of Africa at heart.
The second Russia-Africa summit is scheduled to take place this October-November in Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital, the headquarters of the African Union. Many observers are key to acknowledge the Ethiopian government's courage to hold such a summit in the current climate of Western hostility towards the Russian Federation after Russia invaded Ukraine. In Ethiopia, the United States currently continues its support of its former ally, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, in an effort to destabilize Ethiopia. TPLF ruled Ethiopia for almost three decades under the umbrella of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which was composed of a majority of Ethiopian ethnic groups. Again, here is Dr. Eret, who is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He's a geopolitical analyst.
They did not appreciate his approach, which I think the South African foreign minister called it patronizing and bullying. And, you know, it is. I mean, at the same time, Blinken was doing his idiotic tour trying to threaten African leaders, but trying to sound like he's very nice about it to stay away from Russia and China. You know, he's promoting U.S. Global Fragility Act to provide money to a bunch of countries that the U.S. has kept underwater for a long time, as if money is really what they need. It's not money. It's an honest intention to actually help the people and build the real economy, which there has not been an honest intention. I'm sure this money is tied to many strings attached in different forms of neocolonial operations like green energy, boondoggles, which are, again, colonial in their own way because they prevent countries from having the type of heavy industrial capabilities that they so desperately require to eliminate poverty and bring their people into a better way of living. There's also the Countering Malign Russian Influence in Africa Act, which is being passed soon by the U.S. government, which Blinken was supporting. And the South African government basically called this an offensive act because it prevents countries in Africa from doing business with Russia, and sanctions are even being threatened. Russia, and especially Ethiopia, I think, is one of the strongest nations on the continent because of their anti-colonial history. You know, they've never been successfully colonized. They fought the Italians. They're the only African country which has successfully done this. And because of that fight, they have a tradition and an economic independence, a power to build things like the Grand Renaissance Dam, which is an important driver for a complete African renaissance. It's a 6,000 gigawatt self-funded mega project, the likes of which we've never seen on the continent, which would be a driver for not just benefiting Ethiopian industrial hopes and aspirations, as well as civilian electricity, which is vital in the Horn of Africa, but also Sudan would benefit, Egypt, other Kenya, so many countries, every country would benefit by this. Russia is helping by a variety of ways. They have a military technology and training agreement with Ethiopia. So does China has a military agreement to protect BRI projects like the Addis Ababa Djibouti Railway, which has been built, and there's new extensions that can connect that into Rwanda, where other railway already has been built largely with the help of China. I mean, there's intercontinental railway, which is very inspiring that China was really assisting with a lot. Russia is helping as much as they can. So yes, there will be a second Russia-Africa summit, which will follow up from the 2019 summit. COVID-19 disrupted a lot of the flow that was begun in 2019 when the heads of the Russian atomic energy sectors had meetings with almost every, I think there was 40 African leaders who they met with to discuss and advance projects for helping Africa attain nuclear power in as many countries as possible, which the West has been preventing for a long time due to what I call technological apartheid. You know, it's only South Africa that has had nuclear power because they were under apartheid racist rule of, you know, for a long time. So they were allowed to have it, but no one else was. So Russia doesn't think that way. Putin gave a speech calling for the lighting up of Africa. That's the correct spirit. And I think this coming summit in Ethiopia is keeping many Western imperialists awake at night, having nightmares. And Blinken and Ursula von der Leyen and you know, many other technocratic puppets in the West are being deployed to Africa to try to threaten, bribe, do everything they can to keep Africa under the control of the City of London and Wall Street. But I don't see that they're not being very persuasive or seductive these days. I don't see it working.
Yeah, because Africans have something to contrast. 500 years of history and recent years of exploitation that you have given us so much aid and we still remain the same. So that's kind of something that it's hard to sort of explain. Yeah, that the US will and the West will try their best. But I think the Russians are determined and I think the Africans have to be committed and say this is what we need to do rather than being dictated and given an ill advice that actually works against their interests. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, many African countries, I think 16 or maybe 20, refrained from voting at the UN against Russia regarding the situation in Ukraine. That was a major coordinated, courageous point of resistance as well, where they stood together and they said, we're not playing into these idiotic games. The West destroyed Iraq. They destroyed Syria. They destroyed Afghanistan. And now they're crying crocodile tears over a situation in Ukraine, which is very different. There's no shock and awe. There's no destruction of mass civilian targeting the way the US did under NATO, bombing Libya. None of that. It's a very different situation. And it has much more to do with the fact that NATO has been growing and encroaching upon Russia's perimeter for decades while installing an anti-Russian missile shield, which is openly discussed, and installing puppet regimes that are full of literally Nazi fascists, as we see with the governing structures of what came in 2014 in Ukraine under the control of the CIA, the National Endowment for Democracy, Victoria Nuland. I mean, Russia was provoked and they were pushed into a corner by an aggressive, dishonest agency in the West. And I think, yeah, the African nations who have been so manipulated and abused by this same agency recognize that now's the time to take a stand. And the fact that you have such a strong economic and military intelligence capability coming out of both the Russia-China mutual alliance, it's given them a power to do things they could never have done beforehand, which is lighting up, I think, I hope, a very bright and positive future.
Yeah, it is. When one thinks of being able to travel by train from Dakar to Djibouti, I can't wait to get on board on that train.
me too. No, it's amazing. And yeah, I have many friends who have already traveled a lot in Kenya as well on the Mombasa Nairobi rail. It's a smooth, very affordable, high quality rail system that has been built with China's help, and industrial corridors, agricultural corridors are being created along the way. And this is easily going to extend up into Ethiopia. And there's so many things that have been moving forward. China is already helping on the Western side in Senegal, building up high speed rail. This is obviously part of a much broader design, and you see it with the African Integrated High-Speed Rail Network that involves 9 lines. Some of them are high-speed, some of them are standard electric railways, but it's beautiful. It's really a very strong vision for the future. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to traveling on this too.
But I would like to understand why Russia and China have taken this type of approach. That is contrary to the West. I'm pretty sure it's not. Their interests are there, I'm sure, but there has to be something else that they are looking at things differently rather than the way the West, the lens that the West wears.
Oh, most certainly they are. There's a variety of reasons, I think. As you pointed out, they are looking at things differently. There's a different cultural matrix in the East, which is premised on, I think, you know, these countries are increasingly defining themselves as civilizational forces, and which is more than the simplistic idea of nation states, which emerged out of the 17th century after the Peace of Westphalia in Europe, you know, and the nation state innovation had a lot of good to it. It created a foundation of international law based upon a mutual respect for the borders of your neighbors and to not infringe militarily, you know, if you abide by those rules upon another nation's property and territories. But there's some problems with it too. There's not an appreciation for the deeper cultural continuity of peoples and societies through the simplistic idea of nation states as geographical entities. Whereas, yeah, India, China, Russia increasingly are awakening a deeper appreciation of that. And they don't want to sacrifice those ancient traditions on some idiotic geopolitical game that could lead us into nuclear war and, you know, a burning of the earth and peoples. So they're playing it much more wisely. I think they're appreciating the historical forces much more than the West is. And they know that, you know, that anytime the West has benefited or emancipated its people towards a better way, you know, abolishing slavery in the 19th century, which was a fight, anything like that, was because the West at different times had leadership which brought us into harmony with natural law. You know, it's not just man's law. There's also man's law, they say, is only good to the degree that it conforms with God's law. And that used to be, people in the West used to be more sensitive to that reality. And we've lost that in the world of Hobbesian, you know, my might makes right type of thinking. Whereas in China, you still have a concept of the mandate of heaven, that the laws, economic and political, of a society are only legitimate under the Confucian and even Buddhist worlds if it coheres with the mandate of heaven, you know, and otherwise the law is not just. Russia has an Orthodox Christian connection, which also sees very similar principles, and India has something similar, and many African countries feel the same way. Yeah, I think that there's a certain appreciation for principles and the idea that if humanity is going to manifest our true natural potential, we have to abide by certain laws, higher laws, even if they're not written down. And that involves respect. It involves thinking about the future. It involves avoiding conflict if possible, unless it's defensive, and trying to create unity instead of division, which is the empires always do the opposite. Empires always get their slaves to fight each other. They divide to conquer. They keep their victims as dumb as possible, as uneducated as possible, so that they cannot think in a creative, powerful way. When I look at the effects of Russia, China, and their policy orientation, it's the opposite effects that I'm seeing result, because they appreciate something else.
That was Dr. Matthew Arett on the impact of Russia and China relations and interest in Africa, and this realignment of global forces has the prospects of moving Africa into the path of economic prosperity. Dr. Arett is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow. He is a geopolitical analyst and the director of Rising Tide Foundation, based in Montreal, Canada. The major aim of the Rising Tide Foundation is to foster cultural understanding. Dr. Matthew Arett has authored numerous books, and his recent article entitled Russia in Africa, Connecting Continents with Soft Power, prompted this interview on the impact of realignment of global forces on the African economies. We now take a music and station break. I am Assumpta Oturu. You are listening to Spotlight Africa here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles, and streaming live on kpfk.org. Coming up next is a presentation of what brings to light an understanding of why the Global South views the realignment of global forces as economically beneficial.
Over 400 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we've turned back the tide.